Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the very top of their game. Today I'm joined by David Cohen. David started his career in banking, working briefly in the City of London before moving into journalism. After a brief stint as a freelance writer at The Independent and The Guardian, he joined the London Evening Standard in 2002 as a senior features writer and has stayed at the paper ever since. He is now chief features writer and campaigns editor, and in that role he has spearheaded a number of award-winning campaigns, including The Dispossessed, Get London Reading and Ladder for London. In 2013, he won the Paul Foote Award for Investigative Campaigning Journalism for his Frontline London campaign that helped former gang members form social enterprises. He is the author of three books, Chasing the Red, White and Blue, People Who Have Stolen From Me and Calling London. And in between all of this, he's also managed to run the London Marathon three times and climb Mount Kilimanjaro. David, thanks for joining me.
It's quite an introduction.
It was, actually. Once again, I've got imposter syndrome.
It's a real pleasure to be here.
So you started in banking but didn't last long there. Tell us what happened there.
I actually was working at Rothschild's Bank and I left on the day that I was promoted. I decided to pursue journalism on the plan that if I could be successful at something that I didn't want to do, hopefully I could succeed at something I was really passionate about.
So you always wanted to be a journalist?
I wouldn't say always, but I met a young woman in my early 20s who is now my wife, and she was the assistant correspondent for ITN in Johannesburg. And when I looked at what she did, I thought, this is too much fun for it to be a real job. And I just became more and more intrigued. I wanted to write, and at that point I got a job in a newspaper in South Africa called Business Day, which was sort of South Africa's Financial Times. Then I came over here because I was quite politically involved and I had to either go to jail or leave the country. And so I came, did a PPE at Oxford, and then was faced by the same dilemma. Do I go back into sort of world of finance or do I go into journalism? And I decided to go into the world of finance and lasted about 18 months. I remember the MD, or the CEO of Rothschild's Bank at the time, because I had a beard and I used to wear these very thin, colourful leather ties, and he had told me off for doing this. And on the day that I became Rothschild's very first downwardly mobile professional by leaving, he said to me, "Was it because I asked you to shave your beard or the ties that you wore?" And I said, "No, it's just that I want to do journalism." And I think he and some fellow directors of the bank thought that they would see me selling newspapers or as some sort of downtrodden member of the Fourth Estate. And I did. I left. I really left to go to nothing except to work. I started out as a freelance.
A bold and some would say courageous move at that point then.
Probably. I mean, if I had have known, I had no idea really what it would take in terms of to make a living. My daughter was 6 months old. My wife was very supportive. But there was 1 month I made £20, I remember. But I very quickly got on board and made contacts at The Independent, as it was in the 90s, which was a great paper for freelancers. And I started to sort of make my name writing about men's issues at a time where no one had really done that. So I would typically take the kind of subject you would find in a women's magazine, be it miscarriage or the lack of sex after your child was born, and I would ask men, well, you know, what did you go through when your wife miscarried or when your girlfriend decided to have an abortion? And these were questions that had never been asked of men, really. They were typical fare of women's magazines. But
clearly had emotional implications for men.
Exactly.
Life events like that.
And I remember the story about the baby came but the sex went was sort of made quite a big impact on a lot of my friends and a lot of people, because these were things that people were feeling and talking about but no one was writing about at the time. So I think I was quite lucky. I think one of the things that helps is to find something that where you become the go-to guy, in a sense,
of
editors, a little bit of a niche.
But when you started doing freelancing and kind of being a stringer for The Independent, would you have taken anything that came through the door at that point, any commission or?
No, my first rule, I think, was to I wanted to write for papers that I loved to read. And those for me were particularly The Independent then, and also The Guardian. And I also, at that time, slightly later, got a contributing editor position at GQ magazine. So I was very much, I would sort of meet up with the editors, come up with ideas, and I worked very closely with a friend of mine who was my photographer. And we really did some fantastic stories. We traveled to Kenya, to Thailand, to America, to South Africa, doing features for Guardian Weekend magazine, for the Saturday Independent magazine. And in some ways, you know, those were great sort of days. I mean, the weekend magazines then were slightly different to the way they are now. I think they're much more celebrity driven. There, they were much more into
actual content.
Yeah, reportage.
Real articles.
And I remember the first time I started doing 4,000 word pieces as opposed to sort of 1,500 word double page spreads or full pages in Independent was a big sort of step up for me. But, it, you know, that took some time. It was about sort of a build-up over 7 years.
So when you were working with The Independent, you had some other roles as well. Do you think they were wanting you ultimately to work full-time, or was it freelancing always the way?
You know, I would have bitten their hand off for them to take me full-time. But at that time, for various reasons, as I was about to get that position, the editor changed, or they were shedding positions. And then I had a big slice of luck because I applied for and got a Harkness Fellowship, which took me to America for a year. And I ended up staying 3 years and writing my first book. And that sort of transformed my fortunes in a sense. And that was the first book you referred to called Chasing the Red, White, and Blue, which was a journey in Alexis de Tocqueville's footsteps through America, looking at a sort of social travelogue looking at the relationship between rich and poor, black and white, and looking at how America had changed since the 1830s when Tocqueville, the French philosopher, had gone there and written Democracy in America, which is the greatest enunciation of America by a foreigner that's ever been written still to this day. I mean, that was a wonderful sort of privilege to travel through America, but also to sort of have him as my backseat driver. And when I came back to the UK, I think I was just it gave me a lot more confidence. And soon after that, I was approached by the Evening Standard and became there a sort of much more sort of hardcore investigative, amongst the various things I did. I had to do some quite tough investigative journalism, which was something I really enjoyed.
So in effect, you were headhunted by the Standard at that point.
Yes, and the strange thing was that the people that came to me, I'd never worked for them before. And because I was writing a book, I was writing my second book at the time, I started off 3 weeks on at the Standard, 1 week off writing my book, and that continued for about 8 months till I finished the book. And thereafter, I went pretty much full-time at the Standard. And I've been there longer than I've been anywhere else. Now I've been there, I think it's sort of 12, 13 years.
Quite a journey then. How do you see your career progressing within the Standard then? Has the work led you, as it were, or have you deliberately kind of sought out this incredibly impressive yet unique campaigning activism niche that you have at the moment?
Very, very interesting, Paul. It's been very much organic. I couldn't have dreamed up the current role that I have as campaigns editor. I was feature writer, I was senior feature writer. Keith Dovkans was the chief feature writer. But we were both doing very similar stuff. Then Andrew Gilligan joined, and we had quite a strong team, actually. My top moment was probably when I was sent to America to cover the primary between Hillary Clinton and Obama. And I'd also had early in the year covered Kenya and Zimbabwe. And I remember being one of the first journalists to call that first primary correctly, that Obama would win. And I was feeling pretty chuffed about how things were going. It was a great story. It was very cold. I was in America. And I had to fly on to the next primary, which was, I think, in New Hampshire. And, you know, in America, you have to fly all via the hub airport. So I got to the hub, and I got a call from the features editor, a guy saying, listen, trouble's erupted in Kenya. You've got to divert to Kenya. And so I now had to fly to the next hub airport, which was to New York, and then from there on to Kenya. By the time I got to New York, the message was, no, divert back to New Hampshire and you'll go to Kenya afterwards. And for one sort of glorious moment, I thought of myself as the world correspondent of the Evening Standard,
yes.
Just Africa on one hand and America on the other. And I'd always wanted to be a sort of foreign correspondent. And, of course, the Evening Standard in some ways was a great paper to work for in that sense because it had no foreign correspondents. Mm. So they would send us feature writers to the big stories around the world. And I got to cover some fascinating stuff. And then we had a new editor come on board at the Standard around about 2009. That was Geordie Gregg when the paper was bought out by Evgeny Lebedev and his father. And Geordie asked me to look into poverty in London, given that the paper some 15 years before had done a big expose of poverty in London's East End. And I mean, unbeknownst to Geordie, I had developed a lot of contacts in that area in the 10 years that I'd been at the Standard. And I had also, my book, Chasing the Red, White and Blue, was all about looking at poverty. And I knew what a hard sell poverty was. And I wondered whether this was, in fact, a real poison chalice or a huge opportunity. And as it turned out, the series of features that I wrote and that emerged from that, which also include an expose of mass paupers' graves.
Mm, I remember that clearly.
It led to the Dispossessed series investigation, which at the time wasn't, there was no thought of it being a campaign. And it was only later that we realized, in response to this overwhelming response of readers, to try and raise £1 million, which the Evening Standard had never done. The most we'd ever raised was $250,000. We tried to raise £1 million and we did it in 20 working days.
Incredible.
And we've gone on, Paul, to, it's now standing at, I think, $12.2 million. So that was the beginning.
Genuinely flabbergasting, isn't it, when you think of it? I mean, it's quite an achievement, very impressive.
I think what my, you know, I'm very much see myself as spearheading or part of a team. And I've been very, very lucky in that we get front pages, we get double page spreads. When we launch a campaign, like when we launched Get London Reading as well, it was the first 5-6 pages of the paper. No adverts, just spreads. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, it's human stories that pull people in and make them want to do something. It's the journalism that drives it.
I mean, I want to ask you about some of those very memorable campaigns in a second, but just from a kind of newspaper point of view, do you know of any other newspaper that splashes so regularly on activism-led stories, campaigning on things? It clearly goes beyond the kind of mere reporting of these things. You're actively encouraging the readers to get emotionally and financially involved and commit to being part of the solution.
I think that the conventional wisdom about campaigns used to be, and we used to do it at the Standard too, you would have them for Christmas. So you would have a Christmas campaign typically begin end of November and be over by the end of January. All the papers do it. And the readers got a sense, well, you know, they would get involved or not to some extent. The idea was that people would get bored if you kept on with something. And you, well, with the Standard, we've sort of turned that on its head because we kept going long past the point at which people thought readers would get bored. But the result was that people then thought, wow, you know, these people are actually genuine about it. And it started to have a really powerful effect. And I started to notice this as somebody out there doing interviews with young people. Because initially, in the early noughties, there was a lot of feeling amongst Londoners that the Standard was perhaps a little bit too right-wing for London. London being a fairly liberal city, I would say. And you would get quite a lot of resistance amongst some young people to being interviewed. But suddenly the Standard was seen as cool and the coolest paper to be interviewed because not only were we depicting the problem, but we were also attempting to be part of the solution.
You were genuinely on their side.
Exactly. And I think things changed. I think the paper changed at that point. To the credit of the editors, they really sort of were led by readers. And readers spoke out and we listened. And we're now into the fifth campaign. Every year I wonder what the hell I'm going to do next year. The latest one is using football as an agent for social change. It's called London United, and it's been very, very exciting.
share with us some kind of memorable moments. What's been the one that strikes the deepest chord with you?
I think the toughest one, and maybe the one that strikes the deepest chord, was the one I launched last year called Frontline London. Mm. And this is the one that I'd been thinking about for a number of years. It's the one that tackles gang members in London. And the problem with tackling gang members, this is a very hardcore, chaotic client group. You can't go into a campaign and not have an idea what your end game is. So how are you going to... My initial idea was, well, maybe if we can find two warring gangs and try and get them to make peace, that would be, even if you do it with just two, that and we got the right change agents in, that could signal the way forward for all these other postcode gang rivalries that are generating all these needless deaths. But you pretty soon realize that if you go into something like that and a mistake gets made, not only could you get shot, but someone else could get shot, and the whole thing could spiral out of control pretty quickly. And there's no sort of guarantee as to which way that could go. So I shelved that for a while, and then we tackled youth unemployment that year. That was the Ladder for London campaign.
Another excellent campaign.
But then we came back to it, and I think the interesting thing was we tapped into essentially the entrepreneurial instinct of some of these gang members who are very adept at selling, supplying drugs, knowing how to market it, knowing how to price it.
Quite apart from the ethics, they're quite sophisticated business people, exactly. Entrepreneurs. You know, they have supply chain logistics problems, supply and demand, marketing. It's, you know, ethics aside, it's no different from any other business.
Exactly, exactly. So tapping into that, we decided to... I partnered with Kids Company, who are really brilliant in the, you know, really at the sharp end, to help set up social enterprises, just for a few pilot groups. And my favorite one was two former armed robbers who formed we helped them form a removals company. And the headline was referring to these armed robbers and said, they'll take away your stuff, but only if you pay them.
And did you write that under the subs?
No, that was the subs. That was a great, great headline. Yeah, yeah. And these guys, we started with three, and I knew that if we just had one that succeeded, that would be brilliant. It would lead to the next step. And these two guys have gone on to make £100,000 of turnover in their first year. The others are struggling more, but that itself led to... And what we gave them £10,000 startup grant, which we funded from the Dispossessed Fund, and we gave them some people who would help mentor them. But out of that came a partnership that I set up with the School for Social Entrepreneurs. We got Lloyds Bank and the Cabinet Office to fund it, £150,000 scheme where we had sort of a Dragon's Den-style panel of experts. We put out a call for former gang members who had bright business ideas, who were under the age of 30, to contact us or contact the School of Social Entrepreneurs. They shortlisted 20, and we interviewed them, and we chose 10. And those 10 became... From tattoo artists to young people, juiceologists, to a guy who's wanting to start a boxer-sized gym. Each of them got an £8,000 startup grant, a mentor from Lloyds, and a course at the School for Social Entrepreneurs. So we now have 13 that we've funded. But the interesting thing is the word of this has really spread into the sort of gang community. And the last I heard... Somebody who works in Wormwood Scrubs said, do you realize that your campaign's very popular in Scrubs, that you're trending in Scrubs? And I thought, well, that says it all. That's just brilliant.
But by showcasing how these people are changing their lives for the better, that is good. That is raising awareness that, you know, as you said earlier, crime isn't the way forward, that there is an alternative to these people. And just by inspiring them and making them aware of it, you're making a huge change in the wider community, I would say.
I agree. And I mean, the thing is that what I was trying to do in the series of articles about the gang members was to humanize them without shrinking from really what some of them what had become done, yeah. and what they'd done.
Because it's easy to just label people or stereotype people. There's a generic gang member living in southeast London. You know, it's not a particularly savoury thing, but people do it. And I think, you know, that's a very strong part of what you've done, is actually bring alive these people as what they are, real people.
Thing is, when you look at the coverage, most of the time we write about gang members is when somebody's been killed.
Mm.
And so in that moment, it's just a lot of finger pointing, and there's a lot of heat, but not much light. And what I tried to do is spend some time with these guys. I went to their house from the moment they wake up, their room, if you like. They don't have houses, but and just saw how their day stretches endlessly. There's someone who had just been let out of prison 3 weeks before, and I could see it was just a matter of time before he was going to go back. The lack of support, there was no support for someone who had mental health problems.
Mm.
Who basically didn't want to get out of bed or start his day because the day stretched so long in front of him and it was so much time to do, as he called it, to do madness.
Mm.
And he didn't want to go back inside, but you really could see that without proper intervention, that was just a no-brainer. And you've got sort of 75% reoffending rate within the first year of a certain age group. And I thought, we must be able to do better than this.
Do you think it's because the criminal justice system is almost like a sausage factory? It just processes people. It might give them a fair trial and a jury, but at the end of the day, they're just put in prison. They're kind of warehoused away. They're given no education or training that's going to equip them or indeed inspire them to a better life. And then they're just released.
Yeah, it's a revolving door. And it's terribly sad because these people need proper support. Groups like Kids Company do it. But even that, you know, You look at some of these people, they're released with something like £35 and a probation officer. Now, the probation officer is someone who's seen as someone who is just visits just to get round, to have done, to get it done as quickly as possible.
A box ticker. Yeah. To tick a box.
10 minutes. It's someone who could also send you back to prison. So they have a sort of dual role.
Mm.
So, and there is so much more that needs to be done on that front. And it just seems, you know, here we are, we've come through a period where teenage murder rate in London, and each time it's just a disaster for the young people, but for their families as well. And I just think that as London's newspaper, I am proud that we've been able to think creatively and do in a small way come up with something that is hopefully helping the problem, rather than just finger-pointing and just exacerbating.
So you've clearly worked on quite a number of systemic societal problems, as it were. Do you have a kind of list in a black book somewhere of the next things that you're going to tackle? So 3 years from now, you might tackle this subject and so on. Is it like a conveyor belt of just causes of society's ills that you're going to solve?
I wondered what we would do after gangs. I thought gangs was the deepest... reaching that was sort of a milestone. But then the football campaign, which was Sarah Sands' idea, the editor, was a brilliant idea. And it's also really galvanized. And it really is an area that can galvanize a lot of young people in the year of the World Cup. And there's this grassroots side of football, which can be so powerfully diverting and help give young people who are potentially otherwise pulled towards gangs, give them another sort of team, you know, teams, not gangs, if you like. But as to, you know, if I analyze the campaigns, they're all about social exclusion. And when if you look at the dispossessed, what we set out to do, and we set out the different categories that we would help right in the beginning, somewhat presciently and effectively, the other campaigns have all been, that's been like the daddy campaign, and they all have been tackling some form of social exclusion. The Get London Reading was people excluded through literacy. Ladder for London, people through unemployment and getting them apprenticeships. Gangs, Guns and Knife Crime was another specific mention in the dispossessed of groups we would tackle. And football, we are again bringing people in on some of the roughest estates, getting them football coaches as their sort of Pied Pipers towards something positive. So I don't know. They all involve people rather than issues based, so they're not sort of medical. Sort of, you could have campaigns that look to Bette Midler's campaign to bring gardens to New York, or medical campaigns. The problem with those campaigns is our campaigns have all focused on and been driven by great people's stories. And they've all focused on social exclusion. But between now and March, I will be, I guess, thinking about what the next campaign will be. And I do know what the next sort of, how the Frontline London has got some great things that will be happening in January that will evolve, that will that we will release then. And The Dispossessed also has more to come. Get London Reading, we've just had the 3-year anniversary, and we're about to pass 1,500 apprenticeships created through Ladder for London. So they all continue apace, but we've got 5, and, you know, if I'm still in this job in just under a year's time, who knows? We may launch something earlier in the year, but I don't know at this point genuinely what it is.
If you don't mind me asking, how long do you see yourself doing this? I mean, do you think 5-6 years from now you might be still working on a very important yet different campaign, or do you fancy something completely different? Might you end up the kind of TV reviewer or something, you know, saying what was on Strictly last week? I'm just trying to think of the total opposite of your worthy journalism, really.
I don't really think that far ahead. I've really enjoyed what I've done. It's sort of evolved organically. I've always loved writing. I was very happy being chief feature writer and not being an editor. So that the campaigns editor role happened. I think that I would still like to write more books. I would love to. There's a particular play that I'd like to write.
Interesting.
So it might be that I'm able to do some other things as well. But I don't really see myself. I've never really been a huge. I'm not sure that. I would be great on television. I like radio, though. And who knows? Who knows?
Well, David, we're running out of metaphorical tape, so unfortunately we're going to have to bring the interview to a close. But I'm not just saying this, but if I was only allowed one hand to count the number of journalists that I not only hugely inspired by but also really enjoy reading their work, you would be on that hand. And it's been a great pleasure and a privilege to interview you.
Thank you.
A Big Things Media production. Big Things!